Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's the weekly program about health, nutrition, fitness, and all things lifestyle. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Graham Anthony. This morning we explore the craving mind, from cigarettes to smartphones to love, why we get hooked, and how we can break bad habits. We speak with Dr. Judson Brewer, the Director of Research at the Center for Mindfulness and Associate Professor of Medicine and Psychiatry at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, who will join us to explore this topic.
And then it's the sixth leading cause of death in the country. Few people realize this disease kills more people per year than breast cancer and prostate cancer combined. Sadly, it is the only disease out of the top 10 that currently has no prevention, no treatment, and no cure. It is Alzheimer's disease, dementia. We'll speak with the executive director of the Utah Alzheimer's Association and a local resident who is a caregiver for a spouse with Alzheimer's. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters.
Hey, this is Nick Spitzer. Join me here on KPCW for American Roots, our weekly two-hour music program from New Orleans. We bring you a wide range of American music, Sunday mornings at 11 a.m., supported by Donna Van Buren and Greater Park City Properties. American Roots, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Valley Behavioral Health is a local nonprofit and proud supporter of KPCW. We are your community behavioral health center and provide a broad range of services, including individual, family, couples, and group therapy for mental health and substance abuse. We serve all ages in all of Summit County. Please check out our website at valleycares.com or 649-8347 for more information.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Graham Anthony. Well, you might say we are hardwired to crave things. We are all vulnerable to addiction, whether it's alcohol, a smartphone, love, binge eating, or just about anything that we do repeatedly past the point of it being a positive force in our lives. How do we get hooked into habits? And when does a good habit or an okay habit become a bad one? And then how do we get out of it? Our guest, Dr. Judson Brewer, is the Director of Research at the Center of Mindfulness and an Associate Professor in Medicine and Psychiatry at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. He's also an adjunct faculty member at Yale University and a research affiliate at MIT. He joins us by phone. Judson Brewer, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So I think all of us would say about something in our lives that we know it's not good for us, but gosh, we just keep doing it and it feels pretty good, but then at some point it stops feeling good, but we keep doing it. Why?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, really. So we can, until we really examine our behavior to see what it was that was feeling good and why it's not feeling good anymore, one simple answer there can be that, you know, we do something that's great for a while and then it becomes a habit. And then we look 20 years down the road and we say, why did I ever start doing that?
Yeah. So, you know, of course, Graham and I probably over the last couple of days reading your book have thought about our own individual possible addictions. And so I'm going to just talk about an easy one, because the first thing I think about in the morning, literally as soon as I wake up, is coffee. But then when I have that third cup, like, I want to have that same wonderful feeling, the warm feeling I get. But if I really think about it, it doesn't taste so good on the third cup. So this is all part of what you do. You want us to be mindful and curious about when we get to something like the third cup.
Yeah, absolutely. So we can really ask ourselves, am I doing this out of habit, or is this what's needed right now? And I think the coffee example is a beautiful one, and that, you know, for others it can be eating, for others it, you know, it can be a number of other things, you know, checking social media. So the coffee probably helps wake you up, and you get your caffeine buzz, and all is good. And, you know, our brains are like, boy, that was a good thing. Let's do that again. Let's do that again. Let's do that again. And by the third one, you know, we're like, wait, why isn't this working as well as it did the first time? Well, we don't need as much caffeine because we're already caffeinated. But it's habit at that point. We're trying to get that same hit that we did the first time.
You discuss something you call habit loops. And that's how we form these habits, good and bad. Mm-hmm. But you also discuss that we can use these as a means to exit these bad habits. Can you discuss that?
Yeah, absolutely. The simplest form of a habit loop is it has three necessary components. So it needs a trigger, a behavior, and a reward. And from an evolutionary standpoint, it was set up probably so we'd remember where food is. So we see some food, we eat it, and then we get a signal in our brain that says, you know, calorie, survival. And then that lays down this context-dependent memory that says, remember what you ate and where you found it. So that's a really strong driving force and a very useful learning mechanism for us to survive. The problem is when food is plentiful, that same mechanism is still very much alive in everyday life, and it's looking for something to do. So it says, oh, you know, well, if you're stressed out, why don't you try eating something? And if we, you know, we feel a little bit better, then we start forming these stress habit loops.
And you mentioned the use of curiosity as our tool to get out of these habits.
Yeah, curiosity, it's interesting. So if we can understand how our minds work, understand that we're, you know, sucked into habit eating or smoking or checking our phones or whatever, if we can actually tap into that same process to step out of it. So if stress is the trigger and then we eat a cupcake and that's the behavior and then the reward is temporarily feeling a little bit better, if we take that same trigger, stress, and instead of eating a cupcake or distracting ourselves on our phones, we instead take a moment to get curious about what that actually feels like. It's kind of paradoxical, but when we actually turn toward it, that's what mindfulness practices are all about, are paying attention to what's actually happening right here, we can learn that there's actually an intrinsic joy that comes from being curious itself. And so we can tap into these intrinsic or internal rewards where we don't need something outside of ourselves to feel better. So we've hacked the process, but tapped into something that is zero calorie, but also is, it might even be more adaptive than eating or drinking coffee or whatever.
Can you illuminate how you prescribe meditation and mindfulness to deal with this?
Well, that's a long conversation. You know, here at the Center for Mindfulness, they've been developing training programs for 40 years. And if you look historically, these programs have been developed for thousands of years. But I would say briefly, it's based on the research that we've been doing, we actually ask the question, can we deliver these things at the point of context? If this habit loop is set up in a certain context, like if I'm about to smoke before I drive to work, can we actually deliver the training right there? So we've actually taken to smartphone delivery where we have made a couple of apps and have tested those clinically now where people can get bite-sized pieces of mindfulness training every day for a few minutes a day through videos and animations and in-the-moment exercises paired with an online community, a bunch of other things that can help support them. But we're actually delivering this training right at people's fingertips, literally, now, instead of having them come in to our clinic or some other more traditional setting. And, you know, we've had, for example, our Eat Right Now program, this app for emotional eating. We just finished a study where there was 40% 40% reduction in craving-related eating after just a couple of months of using the app. So we're seeing pretty remarkable change with people just going through this program through their own phone.
Wow, interesting. So I, for example, am about to have my third cup of coffee for the day, and if I get curious about it, really consider it, I'll know it's not going to taste as good as that first cup, but I need some reinforcement. So I just pull up your app and what is it? I mean, explain it a little bit.
What it would do is there are a number of different features on it. So first, that people get the systematic mindfulness training, you know, on a daily basis. There are about 30 modules that people go through. But right in that moment, like you're talking about, we have this thing called basically the stressometer. So somebody, they're like, oh, I'm stressed out. I'm about to drink some coffee. I'm not saying that's the case for you. Or it's habit. You know, you're about to reach for some food. It'll help you walk through this exercise that says, well, are you hungry right now, for example? And check off, you know, what those symptoms are right now, which is basically a mindfulness exercise. And then it'll encourage you to, one, either eat or drink mindfully. So pay attention as you're doing it and see what the results are. Oh, is this something that I need right now, or is this something I'm reaching for out of habit? Or if you know that you're reaching for it out of habit, it'll give you this exercise that helps you ride out the craving. So the acronym is RAIN, R-A-I-N. Mm-hmm. So recognizing that the craving is there, allowing it to be there, investigating, that's the curiosity we talked about, and then just noting the sensations from moment to moment. Oh, it's tightness, it's tension, it's burning, it's clenching. And noticing that these are just physical sensations. And as we get curious about each physical sensation, it comes up and it goes away without us having to act on it like it's a moral imperative.
So you have said, you said a few minutes ago, that we should achieve this intrinsic joy using mindfulness, that we, that we arrive at this place of joy because we have, we have decided not to have our third cup of coffee.
I didn't necessarily say that, but I did say that curiosity itself is inherently, what would you say, it's joyful or unpleasant?
Yeah, curiosity is joyful.
Yeah. Right. So that's what this RAIN acronym is all about, is like diving into that that attitude of curiosity and just getting really curious about what's happening right now.
Right.
And in that sense, it can even flip the valence from something that's unpleasant, like a craving, to something that's a little more pleasant, like being curious about a craving. Does that make sense?
Yes, that makes sense. But I wonder about those who would say, yeah, it's still not as good as that dopamine or serotonin response that you get from doing these things like eating chocolate that just, you know, that just produce a bigger hormone response than you might get from practicing mindfulness. What do you say to that?
I say try it and see.
I like that.
Yeah, because you described it yourself. That third cup isn't quite as good as the first one. That's all we're helping people do is to see, you know, it's not like you're never going to eat cupcakes again or you're never going to. It's about stopping when we're not actually hungry. And when we eat a cupcake when we're really hungry or drink coffee when, you know, right early in the morning, and especially if we pay attention to it and enjoy it, it can be one of the most wonderful things in the world. But at that sixth cupcake, not so much.
Yeah.
You need better cupcakes.
Well, I can promise you. Actually, I had a friend, Dana Small, who did an experiment with chocolate, and she fed people chocolate. She said, eat chocolate, and she kept going, and they loved it. Okay, it was okay. Stop feeding me. So I can promise you, everybody at some point says, okay, that's enough.
We do have our limits. And anecdotally, I can say years ago, I admit I was a longtime smoker, and I designed a process for myself, which I thought about it. I looked around. I stepped outside of myself and observed the person I wanted to be, and I was not a smoker. And I spent months doing that as I smoked. And then I had my last cigarette and I in a pack, and I threw away the empty, and I walked away from the ritual and everything else and never looked back.
Wonderful. That's a beautiful example of changing the habit so that, you know, you can think of even a personality trait as a habit, right? I am a smoker. If you stop thinking of yourself as a smoker, then it's much easier to give up the behaviors associated with that.
Exactly.
Great example. Yeah.
For me, it was I had determined with certainty I was not a smoker, but I waited until my moment to put my foot down on myself.
That's a great story, yeah.
Yeah. I have a friend who had an addiction to alcohol and decided to do this, to practice this. Maybe it wasn't brought to the forefront of her mind, the mindfulness practice, but she said, you know, I think I was just really thirsty all the time. And that's what led her to, you know, when she thought about it, that's what led her to drink alcohol. So she just started drinking water. And I keep that story, I don't know why, in my mind all the time whenever I'm deciding on a second glass of wine. Am I really just thirsty? And so I love that you are formalizing this practice of mindfulness. And I'm curious about your own experience with mindfulness. Like, did the breaking habit idea come first? Did mindfulness come first?
Mindfulness, I actually started meditating my first day of medical school. I'd finished college and had gone through a bad relationship breakup, and you know, it was like I was starting medical school. It seemed like a good time to start, you know, like this is a new chapter of my life. And started meditating. That was over 20 years ago now. And really never stopped since. I was in this MD-PhD program studying molecular biology, and I shifted from doing, you know, genetic mouse work to learning clinical trials and doing neuroimaging during my residency training, because I was so blown away by the effects I'd seen on myself with my own mindfulness practice, and I wanted to see if it could help my patients as well. So the practice came, you know, about 10 years before I shifted my research career to study it itself, and now the two are very much you know, interdigitated.
In your TED talk that I think has been viewed over 7 million times or something like that, am I exaggerating?
No.
Okay. Yeah, that's huge. It was hard to imagine, but how wonderful. Obviously, we are attracted to the conversation about addiction and craving. But you say there that when you started the meditation practice, you would just be sweating because it was so difficult for you, or it was so, I don't know what it was for you. And I just found that really interesting, but you have endured in the biggest of ways. Why were you sweating so much?
Well, I was using my old brute force style methodologies of getting through life, and I would just assume that that's what I would use for mindfulness because I didn't know anything else. It's so funny because that's the opposite of what mindfulness is, and it only took me about 10 years of practice, a lot of sweat and tears. But the nice thing about that is learning that personally, and then also learning the neurobiological mechanisms and how this actually fits together in terms of mindfulness being this effortless quality, this engaged, effortless quality of awareness. It helps me be able to develop programs so that other people don't have to have as much blood, sweat, and tears as they start training themselves.
Do you encourage formal training in meditation and mindfulness?
I think formal training is great. You know, obviously we give mindfulness-based stress reduction courses here at the center, and they're available all over the world now. This was kind of one of the Western, originations of the kind of a Westernized mindfulness training. And I would even say we've tried to package formal mindfulness training, you know, through these apps that I was talking about, as a way to give people training that has 100% fidelity, that we know that fits with the theory, and we know that it fits with the science as well. So if people don't have access to, you know, a meditation teacher or a local meditation group, there are a lot of resources now that are available thanks to this thing called the web and apps, I think, that can provide some nice formal training, especially as a beginning.
So you don't mind if we get addicted to that app?
Well, getting addicted to paying attention is an interesting thing. I haven't seen anybody have detrimental consequences of paying more attention. You know, they don't get, let's see, if I pay attention to my spouse more, that's not a bad thing. If I pay attention when I look, when I cross the street, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's one addiction that I would wholeheartedly encourage.
And there seems to be a lot of scientific research now being focused on mindfulness and meditation and ancient practices that perhaps intuitively we've lost touch with because society and technology and everything else has gotten in the way. Do you think we're just re connecting with who we need to be as human beings.
That's my sense. And I think a lot of people have, you know, reconnected with some of the ancient teachings, which are very simple. A lot of these are very simple practices and very simple theories that actually line up very beautifully with modern day theories. You know, we even wrote a scientific paper showing that the Buddhist idea, this thing called dependent origination, is exactly the same thing as operant conditioning. So, you know, it's kind of like these things get rediscovered over time. And if we can make the links between the two, we can also really try to save some of the core essential elements and make sure that those don't get lost, although they seem to be alive and well.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Judson Brewer. He has written a book called The Craving Mind, From Cigarettes to Smartphones to Love, Why We Get Hooked and How We Can Break Bad Habits. And Judson, you're associated with some pretty heavy-hitting academic institutions, Yale, MIT, UMass. And I'm just wondering, with all of the scientific research, like Graham says, about surrounding mindfulness, is there ever at those universities a pushback or a feel that that's not hard science? Or what is the prevailing thought around mindfulness?
Yeah, it really depends on the person's view. I think we've seen the whole spectrum. I tend to lead with science, and so people, you know, it's kind of hard to push back against randomized controlled trials or neurobiologic differences when somebody's meditating versus not. So I haven't gotten a lot of pushback myself, but I've tended to lead in these scientific institutions with science. I think if I'd gone out there and sat on the floor and, you know, cross-legged and started doing something, you know, that might seem weird to them, I'd probably get a bit more pushback.
Right. And usually I would assume that the pushback is from people who have no meditation or mindfulness practice themselves.
Generally, that is the case. But it's funny because these practices really are pointing towards something that's very universal, which is paying attention. And, you know, that quality that we're talking about, curiosity, that when we're curious about something and we're paying attention, it's hard for anybody to argue that that's not helpful, especially as compared to getting caught up in anxiety or caught up in this or that. So, you know, especially with the skeptics, I say, well, you don't have to believe me, but what happens when you worry about this or that? And they're like, oh, it's terrible. Well, okay, here's how your mind's doing this. And, you know, there might be some simple things that we can do to help you actually break that habit. And, you know, I think more and more it's becoming mainstream. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, again, for a beginner to learn to practice mindfulness, can you go over that RAIN acronym again?
I'd be happy to. So it stands for R-A-I-N. So R is recognize. So we have to first recognize that we're caught up in some type of habit loop. So with our smoking program, it's recognize that you have a craving for a cigarette. With our Eat Right Now program, it's recognizing, you know, that you're about to reach for some food. And we actually now have an anxiety program that we're just in the final stages of. It's like recognizing that you're starting to get caught up in that worry thought loop. Mm-hmm. So recognition is the first piece, because if we can't recognize it, we're lost in the loop. The A is for allow or acknowledge or accept. If we're pushing these things away, we're never going to be able to work with them. So it's simply like, okay, can I be with this? And then the I is investigate. That's the curiosity. Get super curious and get close. Like, oh, what is this? What does this feel like in your body? And the N is note. So we just note one single words that describe our actual experience. If it's, you know, so it'd be like tightness, tension, burning, heat, salivation, or whatever. And we just note that, like, you know, as those sensations arise and as they go away, so that we can actually be with that craving, not try to distract ourselves or do anything to make it go away, and simply watch it arise and go away on its own, and learn that it doesn't have the power over us when we're paying attention that it might when we're not.
If in the end, can we find our authentic selves through this process? And do you have tools for using mindfulness to instill good habits?
It's a great question. I think what it helps us do is see. So if you think of a habit, I don't know what would be a good analogy. It's like we have a car that's a certain color, and we keep painting it different colors on and on and on. So, you know, you're like, well, what color is your car? And right now it's maroon, but it really is white, you know, at its core. If we keep peeling off those layers of paint, we start to see, oh, here's the authentic color of the car. And in the same way, if we start peeling off these habit layers, oh, I'm a smoker. I drink 12 cups of coffee a day. I'm a chocoholic. I'm whatever. As we pull off these habit loops, we get to really discover who we are right here, right now, and in its most authentic way.
Yeah. Before we let you go, I'm just curious about whether or not you've found different, like that there's some type of addiction or craving out there that is different than others, or do they all affect our brain's physiology in the same way?
There's certainly some nuances between each of these, but all drugs of abuse and actually many behaviors now have been shown to affect this dopaminergic pathway in a very common way. So there's probably more commonality than difference, I would say, at least in terms of what matters.
How does ritual play into that?
In what sense? That's a great question.
Well, I think a lot of our habits are a process of we develop a certain muscle memory, and mm-hmm. the attraction of it is to go through a process and certain actions that we master slowly over time, and we're reluctant to give them up.
Yes, that's a great one. So ritual, and again, this is I like the simple definition of addiction, which is continued use despite adverse consequences. So I would say ritual doesn't fall into that, or it could, but tends not to, where we might have the ritual of drinking our coffee in the morning, right? And if it's not causing adverse consequences, rituals can be a great thing. They can be a great way to wake up. And from a neurobiologic standpoint, our brains are actually these prediction machines. They're trying to predict the future and trying to hold things constant. Rituals fall into this familiarity zone. It's like, oh, yeah, coffee in the morning. This feels good. This feels right. And what it really is like this feels like my ritual for the morning. And nothing wrong with that at all.
Yeah, and I find that very satisfying in the end.
Yeah, yeah. So the nice thing about this is if we look at these simple definitions, we can see, oh, it's not like we're trying to become these austere beings. It's simply we're looking to see when our behaviors move out of the realm of ritual and into the realm of addiction.
Yeah, that's so interesting because it makes me think about even the sort of shame that we might feel based on something that there are no adverse consequences to. I mean, truly, a third cup of coffee, the only regret or feeling of remorse that I have surrounding that is that it's something I want that I think I've probably already had enough of. I don't know. And I don't know what my question is there other than, just talking about the shame that we have about lack of control, which may be different than addiction.
It absolutely might be. So it's something you could explore yourself. When you go for that third cup of coffee, you can see, oh, am I just trying to control myself and say, oh, I'll be it feels good if I can say, oh, I'm not going to have that third cup for whatever reason, just so that I can feel like I have control over myself. Or is it something else, right? There are plenty of ways, many ways that we can explore these things to see all of these nuances between, oh, I'm trying to control my life, or, oh, this is an addiction, or, oh, I don't really need that.
Yeah, wow. It's all such good stuff. Well, the book is The Craving Mind, From Cigarettes to Smartphones to Love, Why We Get Hooked and How We Can Break Bad Habits. Oh, and Judson, I just have to ask you about love. I mean, because that's one we know that you can be addicted to love, but I don't know. Can you say something about that before we let you go?
I'd be happy to, and this is also why there are a gazillion songs written about that. You might as well face it, right? But if you think back to somebody that you've known recently or whatnot that just started a new romantic relationship, it's as if they're on drugs.
Oh.
You know? They're either spending all their time thinking about their next use, as in the next time they're going to see this person, waiting for the text, or recovering from the time that they just saw them and letting everybody else know how either wonderful or terrible it was. So it's pretty simple in that same neural pathway gets activated with romantic love as well as even with so that's a strong, so we can get addicted to love, the infatuation pieces, and we can also differentiate that from the type of love that is less fickle, less dependent on me getting something.
Mm-hmm. I'd say we probably aren't human if we haven't had that infatuation feeling, that high that we feel. It's just we need to know when that we can't be constantly looking for that feeling.
Yes, that's strung out.
Yeah,
on love.
Right.
No third cup of love for Lynn.
I love it. Well, Dr. Judson Brewer, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Thanks for having me.
The Craving Mind, again, is the name of the book. It's a good one. I really like that conversation. You can turn to his TED Talk, Judson Brewer. It's J-U-D-S-O-N if you want to listen to that. But the book really explores a lot of great research, and we like research. Stay with us. We'll be back for a conversation about Alzheimer's.
This is Dr. Phil Davidson of Davidson Orthopedics, proud KPCW sponsor of The Mountain Life. Are you reluctant or worried about having a total knee or shoulder replacement? We offer an array of non-surgical and surgical alternatives. More information on our website at davidsonorthopedics.com.
This is Nanette Bush with Fairway Independent Mortgage, supporter and longtime listener of KPCW. Fairway Independent Mortgage offers personal home, vacation home, and investment property lending. Our mortgage team partners with local realtors to provide our clients with resources to understand the home finance process, located at 1700 Park Avenue or at nanettebush.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak here with my co-host, Graham Anthony. Well, it's hard to find anyone, really, whose life has not been directly touched by this disease, either through family or friends who have become afflicted. With no cure, efforts go toward research and awareness of Alzheimer's. On September 9th, here in the Wasatch Back, the Utah Alzheimer's Association will be holding the second annual Wasatch Back Park City Walk to End Alzheimer's event. Support from the community last year was humbling and inspiring, with over $60,000 raised. Ronnie Daniel is the executive director of the Utah chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, and local resident Ray Freer also joins us. He is a local, and his wife was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and he joins to tell the story of being a caregiver. Welcome to both of you. Nice to have you on The Mountain Life.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's just start with some of those statistics, Ronnie. I mean, it's really staggering that Alzheimer's kills more than each year than breast cancer and prostate cancer combined. That was something I didn't know. What physiologically happens to the brain that causes death, or is it other related things that come from it?
It's really both. So what happens with the disease, it's they believe it's a buildup of amyloid beta plaque, protein in the brain that begins to deteriorate the neurotransmissions in the brain. And so for all types of dementia, that's what happens. So dementia, if you think about it as an umbrella term, and underneath that are all different types of dementia. Alzheimer's disease happens to account for about 75% to 80% of all types of dementia. So that's the one that gets most often talked about. But that buildup of that plaque starts in Alzheimer's disease in the memory centers of the brain. And so that's why memory loss is so often associated with Alzheimer's. and then it begins to spread throughout the brain. And as that spreads, it begins to deteriorate the vital functions. And so oftentimes, particularly in the past, the cause of death that was officially noted from someone with Alzheimer's may have been heart failure or respiratory failure or something like that, because of the disease as it spread began to shut down those parts of the body. So people do physically die from Alzheimer's disease. It just so happens to begin to shut down the body in that way.
So is that then to say, because I want to get this correct, that with dementia, there is not the presence of amyloid beta plaque. That's only present in Alzheimer's, and that's the distinction?
No, it happens in all types of dementia. Okay. It just depends on what part of the brain is affected first. So another type of dementia is frontal temporal dementia, FTD as it's called. And so the buildup of that plaque then would start in the frontal temporal lobes of the brain. And so the typical thing that people would see from that wouldn't necessarily be memory loss, but would be more behavior issues. There's vascular dementia, and so vascular dementia is often brought on by a heart condition, so a heart attack or stroke that impacts the brain, and so that plaque would then start in a different part of the brain depending on which part was affected by the stroke or heart attack. But there are multiple types, and even Parkinson's disease is a form of dementia, and so that begins to start the plaque buildup in the motor parts of the brain, and so that's why the tremors and things like that are affiliated with Parkinson's disease. And so it's all, and I should mention that is the best theory that we have right now. That's why, as you mentioned, research is so important, because we don't quite know what's the exact cause of dementia yet. The best theory we have now is the buildup of this amyloid beta plaque.
There is one other aspect to it, and that is 60 to 80% of all dementias are directly related to Alzheimer's.
Yeah, correct.
And this is a disease that's growing in prevalence.
It is. The single largest risk factor for Alzheimer's disease is age. And so as all the other medical advances we see in our world are helping us to live longer, we're more likely to get Alzheimer's disease because of that. In fact, right now at age 65, 1 in 10 people will have Alzheimer's disease or a related dementia. At age 85, it's 1 in 3. And so, you know, 20, 30 years ago, the average lifespan was only, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s. And today, people are living well into their 80s and 90s. And so that's the most significant reason why we're seeing more of it. And so, you know, back in the, 20, 30, 40 years ago, people weren't living as long. And so we didn't see as much prevalence because they often died before they started showing symptoms of Alzheimer's.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. We're just living long enough that something's going to catch up with us. And I can't remember where, but I recently saw a study that seemed to clearly indicate that these plaques are built up over the course of every day, and that our brains purge those plaques during deep sleep. Do you know anything about that study?
That is certainly one of the things that are being studied now. That we know that there is a direct connection to sleep and the occurrence of Alzheimer's disease. So that very well could be how the brain does, you know, cleanse itself, so to speak, of those plaques. And if we're not getting good restful sleep, that begins to build up more. So there's you know, so many things, you know, related to diet and to physical health, and even our ability to learn new things and be cognitively stimulated, and even social interactions are known to play a part in helping us to reduce that buildup. And so if we're doing those things consistently over time, we can reduce our risk for cognitive decline that could lead to some type of a dementia.
So delaying the onset is possible. There is no cure. There is no prevention. But we talk about the diet, sleep, and that sort of thing. And I have to say that, and I know at this point you've probably all heard about Glenn Campbell passing away yesterday. And his Alzheimer's was very public, which always serves to raise awareness. So, right. You know, bless him for that. And after that Sundance film some years ago, Alive Inside, and the effect of music, it made me think about, did that delay the onset of Alzheimer's for him, or did it make him more functioning for longer? And Ray, I want to just ask you a little bit about what your thoughts are on that, because of your loved one who was diagnosed.
Oh boy, yeah. Mary has been diagnosed for about 6 years, and prior to that, she suffered from evidence of the onset of the Alzheimer's. That music and memory was fabulous in the sense, and it's being adopted throughout Utah. The other state that has done it significantly is New York, and Skull Candy has donated substantial resources to that effort with their earphones and so forth. It's a logical thing. But Mary always perks up when she hears music. And it doesn't have to be through earphones. It's just hearing music, and it elevates her mood. No question about that.
You know, it's interesting when if you think about the pathology of this disease, it starts in the memory centers, but it begins in the most recent memories. And so short-term memories is what's most affected. And then it begins to, you know, so if you think about your memory as a filing cabinet, and the most significant memories are at the top drawer, the disease kind of starts from the bottom and erases the most recent memories and goes back. And so the reason why memory or music is such an important trigger is that, you know, music is part of our lives from the time we're just little children. And so I'm sure this was true with Mary. When she hears music that she knew of when she was younger, that's when she perks up more because those are deep-seated memories. And so you mentioned Glenn Campbell. I'm sure that was the case. You know, his music was part of my childhood. My mom loves Glenn Campbell. And so growing up, Glenn Campbell and Johnny Cash were played regularly in our home. And so when I hear Glenn Campbell music, it brings back all kinds of memories for me. And so that's kind of how it works. You know, when you hear a song that you heard in high school, it takes you right back to the high school dance or wherever you were with your friends when you heard that. And that's why it's so powerful, is that our memories are such an incredible trigger to help us in our brains.
And that is the key. It has to be something from her childhood, right, or past. Yeah. It isn't current music by any stretch of the imagination.
Right.
Glenn Campbell's experience with the disease seems, from what I understand, was 6 or 7 years, which I think is at the short end of the duration for this. Mm-hmm. Typically,
the typical from diagnosis to the time someone passes from this disease is about 8 years. But there are people who have been known to live for 20 plus years with the disease, and you know, obviously as short as just a couple of years. In fact, one form of this disease is called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, and it's another form of dementia, but it's a very fast acting disease. And former Speaker of the Utah House Becky Lockhart, that's the disease that she passed away from.
So fast, within a year or something.
It was in a matter of weeks or months. Oh. From the time she was diagnosed until she passed. And so there's various forms of this. That's a much more less common form of dementia, but certainly one that is very fast acting.
Can you address the societal costs of this? It's huge. Ray's not just the only caregiver in
Absolutely.
This house, I'm sure.
So if we think about this in two different ways, you know, the cost to families and caregivers, and just from their own personal medical insurance and, you know, Medicaid and those types of things, the United States is going to spend this year $265 billion caring for people with Alzheimer's disease. And so it's $250 billion is going to be spent. And the significant portion of that, over 70%, is paid for by Medicaid and Medicare dollars. And so whether we think this disease is going to affect us personally or a loved one, if we're taxpayers, this is a huge concern for us, because the trajectory of this disease, if we don't find a way to slow it or cure it, is that those costs are going to quadruple by the year 2050. It's going to be well over $1 trillion. And again, 70% of that being paid for by Medicaid and Medicare. And so that's just unsustainable. I mean, we're just not going to see that possible. You know, we're not going to handle that as a state government or as a federal government. And so it's so imperative for us to find a way to cure this disease. And so as the Alzheimer's Association, that's one focus that we've had significantly, is helping to increase the research dollars to that. And back in 2006, there was only about $50 million going from the federal government to NIH, the National Institutes of Health, for Alzheimer's research. Today, it's $1.4 billion. And so that increase has been strictly because of grassroots efforts like your listeners who will call their members of Congress and advocate for that. In fact, there is currently in front of the Congress an additional $400 million appropriations for Alzheimer's research. And so the House has passed it. Representative Chris Stewart chairs that House committee and has been a strong advocate for that. But it's currently at the in the Senate. And so any of your listeners who could reach out to Senator Hatch, who chairs the Senate Finance Committee, and ask him to look favorably upon that would be much appreciated.
So currently with no cure and no prevention, is there a hesitancy to fund research, or is there the prevailing thought that we've got to do something about this, we've got to put more money towards it, and if that's the case, where are we getting with research?
Yeah, so the answer is the latter, that there is definitely a thought that we have to find a way to cure this, that the alternative is unsustainable, and so we have to find a cure. And it's been interesting, as I've worked over the last 4 years with our state congressional leaders, there has been a shift in their, not only their awareness, but their understanding of the need for this. And so I think we're starting to see, both at the state level and the federal level, our elected officials seeing that this is a huge thing. What's happening with research? There's some incredible things that are happening there. And before I go there, I just want to liken this to where would we be today with cancer if we didn't make a decision 20 years ago to put some resources towards cancer research. And so comparatively speaking, there's over $5 billion annually that goes to cancer research. And so we're starting to see some great results from that. You know, it's very common today that we find and hear about someone who's beat cancer, who's in remission. And that's strictly because of the research that's gone into finding those ways to solve that. And so we need to do that same thing for Alzheimer's disease. But there are some incredible things. So this amyloid plaque that we've discussed, they've targeted that as the potential factor. And so they're finding ways now to, through medications, to deplete the amyloid plaque, to reduce the buildup of the plaque. And so there are multiple pharmaceutical companies that are in phase 2 and phase 3 trials right now with these drugs to see if those will work. So that's very encouraging that that's coming out. Another part of the research that's happening just here, the University of Utah has been selected as one of 16 sites across the country to research the PET imaging. So 5 years ago, there was really no definitive way to look in the brain and determine this buildup of the amyloid plaque. But now they can attach a biomarker to the plaque, and so they can do PET scan, PET imaging, and find out the buildup level of that plaque in the brain and find out what part of the brain is impacted. So they can now definitively say what type of dementia it is. Is this Alzheimer's? Is this frontal temporal? Is this vascular? Based upon where in the brain that buildup is happening. So that's very, very encouraging that is helping us now to determine that. And so the great thing that's moving forward with that is what would happen if, you know, my 51st birthday is happening next week. If I went in and had a PET scan now, could I be screened and start to create a baseline to say I'm having a buildup of that, and I can know about that and know how to maybe implement some better things to reduce my risk, exercise more and eat better and things like that. And so that's one of the things we're pushing for, is for doctors to do regular cognitive screenings and perhaps even this PET imaging down the road to move that along further.
Meanwhile, millions are living with this directly and indirectly. And Ray, can you talk a little bit about the resources that you've been able to tap successfully or with struggle?
Well, I am on Medicare as an aged person, and the Medicare has taken care in Medicare / Medicaid has taken care of much of the problems with my wife's costs, so I'm very thankful for that. And I think what I'd like to say is some of the things that a caregiver has to look out for. You must take care of yourself, because this is a long, long slog, and be gentle both to yourself and to the patient, and you really have to inure yourself to dealing with this over a protracted period of time. You also want to try to empathize with what the patient is going through. They are not dealing with a reality that is yours. You have to deal with their reality. the caregiver cannot influence behavior except for the very shortest period of time. The patient simply will not remember it. And it does absolutely no good to get mad. The afflicted person will have no recall whatsoever of what prompted it, and you just got to be gentle with the people.
I just have to ask you, and I'm sure all of these things that you've come up with in caring for Mary are so effective, and you're a very gentle, kind person. But you said that she was diagnosed about 6 years before, and everyone wonders this. Before the diagnosis, what did you see?
Well, at that period of time is referred to as mild cognitive impairment. And memory would be less than acute. Her faculties, reasoning, interests would not be the same as when she was unafflicted. And then the gradual, the way they define it is mild stage dementia, which is the next stage, then moderate dementia, and then advanced dementia. And as an example of how severe advanced dementia is, she cannot dress, bathe, or go to the bathroom by herself. She may qualify for hospice, and she'll be incoherent, disoriented, and have disturbed sleep. That's the advanced stage. All the other stages are gradations of that.
Right. Well, we have just a few minutes left, so we better talk about this event coming up on September 9th.
Right.
It's the Wasatch Back Walk for... What's the title
so
of it? It's a long
title.
It's
the Walk to End Alzheimer's, and so it's a great opportunity for anyone who's been impacted by this disease, whether you're currently living with it now or if you've lost someone to the disease. We like to think of our Walk to End Alzheimer's as the world's largest support group. So as you mentioned, last year we had just an incredible turnout. We had over 200 people that showed up for our walk. We hope to double that this year and get more and more people to come out. The event starts with the check-in at 9 a.m., and we're going to be out at Kimball Junction at the Swanner Nature Preserve. And so it's a very easy walk. This isn't a race or competition, so it accommodates wheelchairs. So bring out anyone that you want to participate. So we just walk along the Nature Preserve out to the first white barn and back. Folks are familiar with that area. And but then the walk itself starts at 10 a.m., and it takes about an hour or so to do the walk. But we have a very touching ceremony at the beginning of the walk. We actually pass out what we call our Promise Garden flowers to everyone. And there's four different colors of flowers, and they represent the purpose for people who are there. If it's an orange flower, that just means that you're a believer in the cause and you want to help find a cure. If it's a yellow flower, it represents that you're a caregiver. A purple flower represents someone that has lost someone to this disease, and a blue flower represents someone who's currently living with this disease. And for the first year, and we've been doing this walk, the Alzheimer's Association, for 30 years, but for the first time, we're introducing the white flower, which represents our first survivor.
Mm.
And so we're hoping that day will come soon.
Oh, and we don't even have time to talk about that first survivor. But website, can people learn about the first
Absolutely.
Survivor?
So if you just go to alz.org/walk, you can register for the walk. Also go to our helpline if you need more help, is 800-272-3900.
And one more thing, please bring your pets.
Absolutely.
Oh, bring pets. Great.
Pause.
Ray Freer, local resident and caregiver, Ronnie Daniel, the executive director of the Utah chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Thank you so much for joining
our
us
pleasure.
Today. It's The Mountain Life. Stay with us.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air Cruise and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com, Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
You're listening to KPCW Park City. I want to thank our underwriters, Berkshire Hathaway, Home Services Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Davidson Orthopedics, Park City Mountain, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation,